It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. When the novelist David Foster Wallace committed suicide at age 46, American literature lost one of its most influential living writers. A long account of Wallace's life and what led to his suicide was published in The New Yorker in March of the following year. Now, the author of that article, D.T. Max, has expanded the story in a new biography of David Foster Wallace. It's called Every Love Story is a Ghost Story. And D.T. Max is in our New York bureau. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Many critics regard David Foster Wallace as the greatest writer of his generation. Why is that?
You know, I think a number of things go into that. Obviously, just the pure pleasure of his most important books. Reading Infinite Jest is certainly contains more and more pleasure, more agony, more of American life at the turn of the millennium. I think the second thing is simply that he influenced so many people. You know, writers from Dave Eggers to Chad Hurbach, you just can see that he left disciples. I think also something very interesting happened, which is that the web came along, and the web lends itself very well to the kind of writing that David really had pioneered that had nothing to do with the web. And so now you go on the web and you feel like you're reading 10,000 imitators of David Foster Wallace. There's nobody else who's changed American prose to that extent that I can think of in generations. I mean, almost think about someone like Mark Twain.
He was an extremely intelligent and bright child. He had a pretty stable upbringing. His parents were professors. But you write that from a very young age, he was troubled. I mean, he had anxieties and depression.
Yeah, that's right. And I think actually this was probably even a surprise to his family because he was good at hiding these things. He traces his first anxieties back to, I think, being 8 or 9. He speaks about a morbid fear of mosquitoes and buzzing. By the time he's in high school, you know, David is really, I think, he's anxious all the time. There are days when he can't get up and go to school.
You write about this college interview at Oberlin when he had an anxiety attack because you write that at the time, life for him had the quality of performance and being called on to perform within that performance was too much.
That's right. His father told me this story that he was so anxious that basically, you know, as soon as the interview was over, he threw up and kept throwing up. And then shortly after that, he goes to Amherst where his father went. And in those days at Amherst, if you were the son of an alum and they liked you, they would admit you at the interview. So he's admitted at the interview, and then his response was, you know, if I go to Amherst, do I never have to do another college interview? And his father said yes, and he said, sold. And that was how he decided on the college.
He went there to study philosophy, but he was drawn to fiction. How did that happen?
You know, it's an amazing story, because he very much assumed that he would follow in his father's footsteps as a philosophy professor. His family was an academic family. His mother was also a teacher. Who knows what they're going to do when they go to college anyway? But he went through his first 2 years, and he turned out to have a knack for, you know, for sort of mathematical philosophy, mathematical logic. But David had a breakdown in college. So he goes home, and, you know, this is a boy who wrote some in high school, but he wasn't a writer in any sense of it. And really pretty quickly, he begins to turn out extraordinarily good fiction. So much so that by the time he is in a senior at Amherst, and he's only been writing for about a year and a half, he begins a thesis in fiction. He does a double thesis, one in fiction, one in philosophy. But his fiction thesis becomes The Broom of the System, his first, I think, incredibly brilliant novel. One of the kind of cool things I think about David is you can really sense that in learning how to write, what he was really doing was reverse engineering other writers. He was looking at how Thomas Pynchon wrote. He was looking at how Don DeLillo wrote. He was breaking their sentences apart and seeing if he could write them.
You write about how after he graduates from college, he moves to Boston. He's drinking a lot. He's smoking a lot. He eventually sort of emerged from it. But, of course, as we know, his life, the cycle of his life was one of addiction and recovery. And they never left him.
Sure. He always referred to himself as an addict. He becomes deeply involved in 12-step recovery programs. And his life changes. You know, I mean, he wouldn't have made it even into his mid-30s, I would think, had he not found the strength to get away from his addictions. Now, his primary addiction was marijuana. It was not drinking. And in a lot of ways, you know, one of the things about David that's so interesting is that his life, the accidents of his life, really gave him the key to his writing. And in a lot of ways, the 12-step program is what taught David how to write Infinite Jest, or where the book should go, that it should be more than just a pretty piece of fiction.
The last year of his life, by all accounts, including yours, was things were going pretty well for him. He was in a stable relationship, was living in Southern California, in Pomona, where he had a job at Pomona College. But then on September 12, 2008, he committed suicide. And at that point, he had stopped taking antidepressants. Were you able to find out why?
I think there's a couple of reasons why. Physically, the antidepressant he was on, Nardal, is hard to metabolize, and it was kind of an outdated antidepressant. He was also just miserable that he couldn't get his novel, The Pale King, the book that was published just last year, because David works on it for a decade. But, you know, the writing wasn't coming. He thought that the Nardal was perhaps interfering with his ability to write well because, you know, it made things seem a little distant, made his own relationship to reality a little bit less keyed up, and he wondered if he could just get rid of the Nardal, that would help his writing. And then the third reason, which is something I discovered in working on the book, is that, you know, having been a member of this 12-step program, there's a whole group of people within 12-step programs who think you should be completely drug-free. No alcohol, no marijuana, no prescription antidepressants. So poor David, who always wants to be the best student of the class, wanted to be the best possible 12-step program participant. And so he thought, well, I'll just get off it. And once you're off one of these drugs, it can be very, very hard to stabilize yourself again. And he just wasn't able to.
I want to ask you about the title of this biography, Every Love Story is a Ghost Story.
Well, it's, you know, shortly after I began the book, I started to come into possession of letters that David had written to other people. But David didn't keep any letters, so all I have is David's letters out. And noticed again and again in different places he would put in the phrase, every love story is a ghost story. It starts when he's a graduate student in the mid-'80s. The phrase appears in The Pale King. The title probably came to him through reading some correspondence of the novelist Christina Stead. But why did that phrase stick in his head for so long? It seems to me that it captures so perfectly what he always felt was the futility, the difficulty of not just writing about people, but actually being with people. He had a great deal of trouble in his relationships and a great deal of trouble, you know, understanding relationships. And then, of course, I also felt like that was really the reader's relationship with David. It wasn't really just a reference to his suicide, but obviously it contained a big aspect of the fact that he was gone now. And whatever love readers felt for him was now going to be a love for an absence, for a ghost.
That's New Yorker writer D.T. Max. His new biography of David Foster Wallace is called Every Love Story is a Ghost Story. D.T. Max, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Author Paul Tough spent time in some of the roughest neighborhoods of Chicago. He was watching young men and women who found a way to overcome unimaginable challenges. One teenager who caught his eye was named Keitha. She was sexually abused by a relative as a girl, fought a lot in school, and was on the verge of dropping out. But then she entered an intensive mentoring program that changed her life.
She made it through high school, overcame a lot of obstacles, and now she's getting a cosmetology degree. So for some people, that wouldn't be a huge success. For her, she has overcome these obstacles that I think are not only going to set her on a path for material success, but also sort of a richer psychological success.
And success is what Paul Tough delves into in his new book, How Children Succeed: Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. He argues that success is not always about IQ scores or standardized tests or the fattest vocabularies. It's often about the ways young people build character.
For some people, that path through college is so easy that they can get out into life and they've never really been challenged. And I think that they get into their 20s and their 30s and they really feel lost. They feel like they haven't had those sorts of character building experiences as adolescents, as kids, that really make a difference when you get to adulthood.
And the difference maker can vary depending on the person. Mentoring programs that focus on goal setting can certainly be helpful. He also says parents should try to teach their kids how to manage stress from a very early age. In the book, Tough brings up some pretty hardcore science. And when he joined us from our New York bureau, he told me about one group of researchers who were studying baby rats.
They had noticed that when baby rats got stressed out when they were handled by lab technicians, let's say. There were some mother rats who would lick and groom their baby rats and others who would not. And so the scientists got interested in this one particular behavior, and they tried to figure out what kind of difference it made. And as they did a series of experiments, they found out it made a huge difference. The rats who, as babies, were licked and groomed did much better on all sorts of things when they reached adulthood. They were braver, more curious. It had actually changed the shape of certain parts of their brains. And so I think there's a real parallel there for humans. We don't know for sure that our brains work exactly like rat brains. But I think there's a lot of parallels between that and the research on attachment, that psychologists who have studied attachment have found that when human kids have that same kind of licking and grooming style bonding with their parents, especially in the first year of life, it gives them all sorts of psychological strength, confidence, character that when they reach school age and even into adulthood will make a huge difference in how well they do.
Now, this is going to surprise some parents, I think, because a lot of parents worry about suffocating their kids with too much attention and doting on them and so forth. Is that not a problem? Is the key really to give them as much affection as possible when they're really young?
I think this is a real trick of parenthood, which is that I think there are two stages, and it's hard to tell where the transition goes from one to the other. When kids are really young, my sense from the research is that you really can't be too loving, that really what kids need at that point is just support, attention, parents who are really attuned to the child's needs. But at some point, somewhere around one or two or three, that really starts to change. And what kids need is independence and challenge.
You bring up a lot of keys to success. I mean, kids kind of learning how to confront failure and confront stress, developing really a strength of character, having parents who, you know, this attachment, this idea of attachment, parents nurturing them when the kids are very young. Now, there have been a lot of assumptions like, you know, high IQ tests, big vocabularies that we all assume predicted success. Are you just blowing those old assumptions out of the water?
Not entirely, no. I mean, absolutely, cognitive skill and IQ make a big difference. Vocabulary matters. But the scientists, the economists and neuroscientists and psychologists who I've been studying and writing about are really challenging the idea that IQ, that standardized test scores, that those are the most important thing in a child's success. And I think there's lots of evidence out there now that says that these other strengths, these character strengths or non-cognitive skills are at least as important in a child's success and quite possibly more important. But right now we've got an education system that really doesn't pay attention to those skills at all. And so we're very good at trying to build those cognitive skills. But for some kids, for most kids, they really need a whole lot more in order to succeed.
You said something that caught my attention there, an education system that does not pay attention to those types of skills that you're talking about. What do you think exactly is lacking?
Well, I think schools just aren't set up right now to try to develop things like grit and perseverance and curiosity. I think especially in a world where we are more and more focused on standardized tests that measure a pretty narrow range of cognitive skills, teachers are less incentivized to think about how to develop those skills in kids.
And Paul, you have a son, right?
I do.
How old is he?
He's 3.
I'm curious to know how your approach has changed as a parent after digging into all this research.
My wife and I had our son just as I was diving into this research, and so I've spent a lot of time, you know, going back and forth between playing with him on the floor and then reading these neuroscience and developmental psychology papers and trying not to let them influence me too much. But I think I took a couple of things away. One was really in infancy, that kind of attachment-promoting behavior, that helping him manage stress the way that those mother rats helped their pups manage stress was a hugely important thing, and that was going to make a big difference in terms of how his brain develops, how his stress response system develops, and that was going to help him a lot going forward. But now I really find myself wrestling with this question of how to make this transition into standing back more and giving him more challenge and letting him fall down, sometimes quite literally, and not pick him up and let him pick himself up. And definitely what I find, and I know lots of parents have found this before me, is that he really likes that. You know, what he wants at this stage of life is to prove that he can do everything. And I think it's the most valuable thing I can do for him right now is to stand back and let him do that.
You've certainly given parents a lot to think about as they go into this new school year. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Well, thank you.
It's Paul Tough, author of the new book, How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Writer Zadie Smith burst onto the literary scene with her first novel, White Teeth, more than a decade ago. Set in the ethnic neighborhood in northwest London where she grew up, White Teeth captured the diverse, vibrant rhythms of a city in transition. Zadie Smith returns to the same place in her new novel, N.W., but as NPR's Lynn Neary reports, this is a more sober look at where life has taken some of the people who inhabit this corner of the city.
Zadie Smith's mischievous sense of humor is still on full display in N.W., as is her playful love of language. But this is an older, perhaps wiser writer than the young woman who dazzled readers with her first book. Where White Teeth was a wild ride into a whole new world, N.W. is a more complex exploration of where the inhabitants of that world have landed. Smith says her decision to return to her old haunts for the setting of this novel was in part purely pragmatic.
I knew I was going to write a book which was in some ways difficult stylistically and difficult for me to write, so I just wanted to give myself a break. You know, I needed one thing which was stable that I knew. And in the streets I do know, and they don't take research, and I don't need to use Google Maps. They're kind of a deep knowledge in me.
The story of N.W. is told in four sections, each focusing on one of four characters, each written in a different style. Smith says she doesn't think of the writing in N.W. as experimental.
The question in my mind was slightly different. It was about trying to be closer to reality, more real and more honest. And life seems to be speeding up. It used to be that I felt like I was 5 for 100 years and now I've been 32 for 10 seconds. And that concept, which is not, they don't mean that as an experimental statement or even a particularly theoretical statement, it's a genuine feeling, but most narrative doesn't get anywhere close to replicating that genuine feeling. So I wanted to try and do that.
The central relationship in the book is the lifelong friendship between Natalie and Leah. They grew up in the same housing development, attended the same school, played in the same parks. But as adults, their lives have spun in different directions. Leah works for a charity and is married to a hairdresser. She's paralyzed with self-doubt, while her best friend Natalie, a wealthy and successful lawyer, seems certain she is going in the right direction. Smith tells Leah's story in a kind of languid stream of consciousness, while Natalie's narrative is made up of 185 separate segments, some as short as one sentence.
She's this character with an incredible kind of gift for the future. She's so sure that her life is moving in this rational forward momentum. So I wanted to give her a narrative which replicated that feeling. Certainly not the way I feel when I'm living my life, but Natalie's so forceful in that way. She's always looking ahead. And also, I suppose I was reading a lot of philosophy and things which were separated into that kind of numbered argument. I thought it'd be interesting to try and present a life in that way.
Natalie and Leah still live in the same neighborhood, but Natalie now lives in a big house overlooking a park. Married to a wealthy man, the mother of two children, she hosts elegant dinner parties and casual brunches that make Leah uncomfortable. To Leah, it seems as if her friend has crossed over into a different world and a different class.
Leah looks down at Olive and strokes her ardently until the dog is discomfited and slinks away. She looks up at her best friend, Natalie Blake, and hates her. Leah, always trying to save somebody. Isn't that your job? Defending someone is very different from saving them. Anyway, I mostly do commercial these days. Natalie crosses one bare leg over the other. Sleek, ebony statuary. Tilts her head directly to the sun. Frank, too. They look like a king and queen in profile on an ancient coin. Leah must stick to the shade of something Frank calls the gazebo.
The two main male characters in the novel, Nathan and Felix, don't know each other, and their lives only intersect momentarily, with profound consequences. Felix, the youngest of the four, seems just on the brink of setting his life straight. Nathan, who went to school with Leah and Natalie, has fallen on hard times, though he retains some of the charm that once made him the object of a schoolgirl crush. Smith has chosen to let readers get to know Nathan primarily through dialogue.
I was really struck, I suppose, during the riots in London, so many people so willing to stand up and describe or comment or explain the behavior of young black men, people who have never met a young black man unless it was to cross the street to avoid him. And I found all that commentary so tiring, this assumption of understanding. And in Nathan's case, I wanted to leave him alone. I wanted him to speak with his own voice, as much as that's possible in fiction, and just to exist outside of commentary or control.
Smith never mentions that Nathan is black. In fact, she never describes any character's race unless the person is white. Smith says she doesn't really expect all readers to notice that, but she liked turning the idea of race on its head.
Well, you know, I grew up reading a generation, American and English, people like Bellow, Updike, or Amos. Everybody's just neutral unless they're black. Then you hear about it. The black man, the black woman, the black person. And of course, if you happen to be black, the world doesn't look that way to you. And I just wanted to try and create perhaps a sense of alienation and otherness in this person, the white reader, to remind them that they are not neutral to other people.
At the end of her novel, Smith leaves the reader with this question. How is it that four people can begin their lives in roughly the same set of circumstances and yet end up in such different places? It's a question, Smith says, that she has no intention of answering.
I really meant it to be a question for every reader. The question of whether people get what they deserve, it's a, in the one way, just a simple demotic thing that people say to each other. But in the end, it's a very serious ethical question, whether you believe that or not, creates all kinds of political difference and moral difference. So I don't want to enter into it. The book was written exactly for that reason, to create a little problem you enter and solve for yourself.
So far, N.W. has been met with mixed reviews. Some critics love it. Others, not so much. But Smith says she's not trying to create something that will please everyone. I love novels, she says, and I don't want them all to be the same. She loved writing this one because it was a challenge. She leaves it to readers to take up the challenge if they choose. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And you can read or download audio of an exclusive selection from Zadie Smith's NW at NPR Books, where it's part of our new First Reads series. Go to nprbooks.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Arun Chaudhry claims the honor of being the first official White House videographer. He's written a book about his 4 years in the almost constant company of the president, the story of Chaudhry's journey from a disheveled film professor to first cameraman, which is the title of his book. Chaudhry was hired by official White House photographer Pete Souza. His book is an often funny, generally admiring account of the life and times of candidate Barack Obama, then President Obama, and the sleepless nights and fun-filled days of the man trying to record it all. Arun Chaudhry joins us from our New York studios. Welcome to our program.
Thanks so much.
Now, lots of presidents have had photographers. Some of them have become like members of the family. They've had extraordinary access to the president. But you insist that your role was different, first in the campaign and then in the White House. Different how?
Well, I think the addition of audio is such a crucial component. You know, a photograph is a kind of art that we bring so much of ourselves to. You know, someone looking solemnly out a window can mean all these different things. Once the audio is there, the mystery's gone. And so it becomes a much more dangerous proposition to have a videographer around than to have a photographer around, which is generally ennobling.
So what was your assignment? I mean, what did they tell you they thought you ought to do?
Well, right in the beginning, I was being brought on to go on the trail and to make sure the speeches were being posted and things like that. But in the back of my head, I thought the real job of any smart young filmmaker working for a campaign has to be to think of that brilliant 30-second ad that's the one that just transforms the election. You know, we all dream of being the one who makes the Daisy ad from the
right cycle.
And then quickly realized that all these little clever things I was doing on the side were not getting the hits, the attention that uncut speeches from Senator Obama were. the victory speech in Iowa or the race speech. These were the ones that were the real quote-unquote viral hits. And so the discipline definitely became, how can we get this person, this candidate, in front of as many people as possible? And so, you know, live streaming, putting the speeches up, doing everything quickly. You know, if you couldn't make it to a gymnasium in Iowa, we were going to make sure you had a way to see the candidate speaking in your town, speaking to you.
The president's advisor, David Axelrod, says in your book, "We thought the video could be the life of the campaign online, an authentic mirror of the campaign." Can something like that really happen? I mean, surely a campaign always wants its best face forward. The White House always wants best face forward. What's authentic about that?
I think you can still have a point of view and be authentic. I think we have a false sense of neutrality from our government, from sources. We want this sort of anonymous stuff. And I think the material that I produced has a little more personality, which I don't think makes it a scary proposition. I think it allows people to actually know where this information is coming from.
Okay, now this is a test. Did you ever shoot anything that was such an unpleasant view of Mr. Obama that you and everybody else knew that that video was going to vanish?
Well, at the White House, nothing vanishes. I'm actually subject to something called the Presidential Records Act, which I think due to the misdeeds of a certain President Nixon, everything you do in service of the president is in the archives forever. And so every frame, every mistake, every out-of-focus shot, everything, every time the president swears because he makes a mistake in the weekly address, all that stuff is in the archives somewhere and will be available to the public.
Now, what was the best bit you captured in your 4 years?
You never know exactly what you're going to run into, but there was one day when I was just getting ready for the Easter egg roll, which, as you know, is a traditional event at the White House every year. It's really nice. Lots of kids come.
You were going to rip the lid off Easter egg rolling?
Yeah, I was going to make, you know, the very best White House Easter egg roll video that had ever been made. And when I got into the Blue Room, I came upon the president and Sasha Obama punching Easter Bunny in the stomach. Just letting them have it. It turned out to be Brian Mosteller, the deputy director of the Oval Office operations.
Dressed up as an Easter Bunny.
But it's a strange thing to walk into a room and just see the president and his daughter, you know, beating up what looks like an oversized Disney animal.
Now, you tell several stories in the book where things went south on you. Tell me another one.
You know, every now and then I would push my authority a bit too far, you know, because I got such free rein at the White House that it was hard not to want that when you get other places, too. And so we arrived at the Indian Parliament, and someone looked at me and saw my camera and says, "Oh, you must be Pete Souza." And Pete did have access to the thing that I kind of wanted to shoot and was already with the president, and so he was already in position. And I was like, "Yeah, sure, why not? I'm Pete Souza. Let's see where this goes." And where that ended up going was around a winding set of corridors and to someone who identified me as not Pete Souza. And then that led me to the back door of Indian Parliament, where I was unceremoniously thrown out of Indian Parliament by my belt.
they grabbed the back of your coat and the back of your trousers and
That's
threw
right.
you?
That's right. It actually works. You know, you see it in the movies. You're like, I wonder if someone did this, someone, if you really could throw them through a door. Yeah, I'm here to tell you. It works.
Arun Chaudhry's book about his years as videographer to a president is called First Cameraman. Mr. Chaudhry, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, thanks so much. It was really fun.